September 2021, the month in review. We are exiting September in Maine with a surge in COVID cases. Today, the Maine CDC is reporting the largest increase in one day so far. Partly that number is from a backlog of test results, but it is still far from where we want to be at this point in the pandemic. And other big news this month, the state's redistricting commission finished its work, and the legislature approved the new map. Augusta moves to the 2nd Congressional District. And at a rally in Augusta, former Governor LePage announces he will run for his old seat, and Senator Collins endorses him. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Today on Maine Calling, we discuss these stories and more with our panel of newspaper editorial page editors. What stories mattered most to you? Maine Calling is next, but first, this news. And welcome to Maine Calling. I'm Jennifer Rooks. COVID continues to dominate the Maine headlines as September comes to a close. Other news of interest this month, congressional redistricting plans are in place, legislative redistricting plans as well, and former Governor LePage has formally, as opposed to informally, announced his campaign to run again for governor. Joining me to discuss the news of the month, Susan Young, who is editorial page editor for the Bangor Daily News, Greg Kesich, editorial page editor for the Portland Press Herald and Maine Sunday Telegram, and Ben Bragdon, editorial page editor for Kennebec Journal and Morning Sentinel. We invite your questions and your comments. As always, send a brief email to talk@mainepublic.org, tweet at Maine Calling, find us on Facebook or Instagram, or give us a call at 1-800-399-3566. Again, 1-800-399-3566. And don't wait till the end of the show. Often we have a whole lot of calls and emails coming in at the end of the show when we don't have time for all of you. So if you're thinking of calling, maybe call 5 or 10 or 15 minutes earlier. Susan, I think we'll start with redistricting. The legislature approved and the governor signed off on the plans this week. We know that Augusta will now be in the 2nd Congressional District, but Waterville will not. How significant in your mind is this? And also, have you been following what the new legislative map means, especially for those in your coverage area?
And as we've written, redistricting in Maine, unlike other states, isn't a real complicated or contentious affair. There's really strict guidelines on what the districts need to look like. And also this year, really tight deadline for this apportionment commission to get its work done because of the delay in the US Census. So always political wrangling. Both parties want to gain advantage. But especially at the congressional districts, we have two of them, so there's not a lot you can do. And moving people around is not going to change the outcome of elections. There's just not enough people. Some more contention over the legislative maps, especially the state Senate. Some of the districts, some of the proposals were more extreme than others. But as usually is the case, in the end, the commission agrees on changes that aren't really significant because no one wants the Supreme Court to end up drawing the boundaries instead of the commission. And so that's what we ended up again with this year.
But Ben, you know, we think at this point that the outcome of the elections won't be affected, especially when we're looking at congressional races. But the second district races have been close. And famously, the last one ended up in a ranked choice runoff, if you will. Will Augusta, which leans Democrat, perhaps decide the outcome of the next congressional race?
Well, when it's so few votes, then you know, anything can make a difference. But it also is hard to, you know, kind of game these things out too far in advance until, I mean, certainly the district becoming, you know, ever so slightly more Democratic helps the Democrats in some way. But that's just kind of one factor that goes into it. I have heard some people in the Waterville area say that they felt they fit better in the second district. But when you look at the numbers, that's just not true. Maybe that is has something to do with what they think the city is or used to be. But you know, they every 10 years they wrangle to figure out, you know, which what movements might help their party and what movements might hurt, and then they have to come up with a compromise. And you know, each time they hope that they slip one by the other party and get one through, but it doesn't always work out that way. I know that there was some districts down in the Portland suburbs, you know, 10 years ago that Republicans I think thought would go one way and maybe have ended up going the other way and vice versa. So, you know, I think with the process that Susan described, we usually end up coming out as, you know, as fair as it can get. And then it doesn't really end up doing much for either side.
Greg, any sense of how this changes the makeup of the legislature? Obviously, we know that Southern Maine has been gaining people, has been gaining population. So therefore, Southern Maine will have more seats in the legislature after the next election. How dramatic will that feel if you're sitting in the state house?
Well, first I should say, as a disclosure, my daughter was a staff member for the commission. And so I have an idea of how hard they worked and the kind of effort that was put into it. I think, you know, because we have a bipartisan system and not a nonpartisan system, there's a lot of interest in both sides in keeping incumbents in their districts and not pitting them against each other. The way you might if you just sort of randomly, you know, had a computer draw a map based on population. Maine is a state where you have to live in your district. You know, it's not true for Congress. Anybody can run for Congress, whether they live in the district or not. But in the legislature, you have to actually physically live in your district. So if a line moves and you're out of it, that's a big deal. You know, you have to either move or run for another district. So I guess we won't see those kind of dramatic changes because a lot of incumbents are going to be, you know, kept in the districts or something similar to the district they've had all along. There's a few exceptions.
I'd be interested in seeing a map, though. Does that make for some strange looking districts when you do redistricting if you're trying to keep the incumbent in his or her district?
Well, they all look strange to me. I don't know, Jennifer. I'm glad it's not my job. The map is going to, you know, it follows where the people are. To your initial question, there's going to be more towns that went for Democrats in the second congressional district than there were last time around, and there's going to be more. I don't believe that there's any Senate seats lost what would be fall within the second congressional district. But I don't think it's going to be a big dramatic change. And I think that's sort of what our system where you have to come up with a bipartisan solution that'll get two-thirds support in the legislature. And that kind of argues for, you know, very small change.
All right. Well, let's move on. Let's talk about the pandemic. One of these days we're going to do the month in review and we're not going to be talking about it anymore. Let's see, Ben, I'll start with you here. New numbers out today. The highest one day number count yet from the Maine CDC. An important qualifier that these numbers are not all from the last 24 hours, but the reason is not a good one. The reason is because they're so far behind in testing. So by any measure, this is far from where we wanted to be right now. I was looking at a map of where the cases are. They are the rural counties in Maine, much, much higher case counts per capita than the more populated counties.
Yeah, I mean, as you said, the daily numbers aren't all from one day. It makes it a little difficult to tell which way we're going in this. Although the CDC did say yesterday that there's been a slight downtick in the number of positive test results they're getting each day.
And we have temporarily lost our connection with the main calling program.
Welcome back. This is Jennifer Rooks, and this is Main Calling. We've had obviously some technical issues here, and we welcome back you to our monthly Month in Review program. Thank you so much for staying with us. Back with us, Greg Kesich, Susan Young, and Ben Bragdon with the Portland Press Herald, Bangor Daily News, and Kennebec Journal. We are going to be taking calls. We think we figured everything out. 1-800-399-3566. I think when we had our technical problems before, Ben, we were talking with you and we had started to talk about the pandemic a little bit and the surge in cases that we were seeing, especially in rural areas.
Oh, good. I was hoping to talk about COVID again. it was just a warm up, I guess. We're seeing high daily numbers now. We don't know exactly when some of these people are testing positive. It's sometime within the last couple weeks. The CDC says, that they're seeing fewer positive tests sent into their office every day, slightly fewer. A lower rate of COVID tests are coming up positive, which are both signs that we might be kind of hitting an ebb with this surge. It would kind of match other places that have a high vaccination rates that saw Delta really sweep in and do some damage, but kind of run out of fuel. Hopefully that's where we are. It's a good sign what's happened elsewhere. It's a good sign that Maine's vaccination rates keep going up. We've had a number of vaccine mandates that are coming in that are making a difference. The booster rates or booster shots are going to help specifically, the most vulnerable people in Maine. And the pool testing that's now getting up and running in schools should be able to help catch some of these things. There doesn't seem to be much evidence that the COVID is spreading in schools, but there's so much spread in the community that kids are certainly bringing it in, and that's shutting down schools, causing a lot of problems. And hopefully that with pool testing, we can keep kids in school and catch these things before they really break. But we don't know what the next month is going to bring, and it seems like it's going to be a pretty important month if people keep getting their shots and keep being responsible. We could get this down in front of what could be a long winter. But at this point, trying to make a guess of what's going to happen 2 months ago, 2 months from now is pretty tough and almost foolish.
And Susan, having this conversation on the day that was going to be the deadline for healthcare workers to be fully vaccinated, the deadline still exists, but the Mills administration has announced it will not be enforcing it for another month. And then the story out just this week, a heartbreaking story, Christina Baker Klein, the author who's so well known for Orphan Train and The Exiles and other books, talking about her father who died in a Maine hospital after being exposed to COVID by a healthcare worker, not being able to get into a rehab bed because of the COVID surge, all of it coming together, talking about Eastern Maine Medical Center, talking about healthcare workers not vaccinated, just really putting just such a sad chapter to this story.
Yeah, I mean, our hospitals, unfortunately, are still overwhelmed. We still see high hospitalization rates, utilization of intensive care units. Most of that is among people who are not vaccinated. I think it's around 90% of folks who need this intensive treatment for COVID have not been vaccinated. But as you point out, the situation with Bill Baker shows the danger that folks who are vaccinated, who need medical care for things beyond COVID, are also at risk, either from not the hospital not having capacity to treat them at all, or you know, when they get mixed in with a population with a highly transmissible virus, it can be very dangerous. We'll see with the mandate going into effect today for healthcare workers. We also see concert venues and some businesses requiring proof of vaccination. You know, is that going to make a difference for some folks who have been delaying getting a COVID vaccine? Is that going to finally encourage them to do it? And will that make a difference? You know, as Ben said, the weather's changing. As we start spending more time indoors, there's a lot of reason for worry. But as journalists, I guess we have to remain eternally optimistic that there are going to be incentives that encourage people to get vaccinated.
And I'm thinking, Greg, about your paper running, your columnist Bill Nemitz had a really powerful column a couple weeks ago about a couple who both died of COVID who had not been against the vaccine until becoming involved. They did not name the practice, but it seemed like possibly a chiropractor practice that convinced them not to get vaccinated.
Yeah, I mean, it's there's a lot of confusing information. Or misinformation flying around, and people are looking to trusted sources, and a lot of very prominent people and people with, you know, high positions of trust, such as a healthcare provider, end up you know, giving them the information they need that tips them over one way or another. There was a really interesting Kaiser Family Foundation survey that came out this week that talked to vaccinated and unvaccinated people. And you really can see two very different worldviews. They asked vaccinated people why they thought there was such a big surge in hospitals and intensive care units. And they said that it's because people are refusing to take get a shot. And they asked unvaccinated people the same question, and they said it's proof that the vaccines don't work. And it's true that there are unvaccinated people in the hospitals. I think Dr. Shah said that 65 to 75% were in Maine were unvaccinated of the hospitalized, and 90% of the people in intensive care were unvaccinated. But people are looking at that, you know, the 33 to 35 to 25% and saying, well, you know, if they're vaccinated, how come they're in the hospital? And the fact is that almost everybody is vaccinated. 70% of people are vaccinated. And that's a much bigger group of people that's producing a much smaller number of sick illness. And, you know, we can argue this till the cows come home. But until these mandates come into play, there's going to be, you know, people who are spreading misinformation, and there are going to be people making choices that put everybody else at risk.
There's one more story I want to at least touch on before we get to our callers and emailers. And Greg, I'll turn back to you first for this one. He has been hinting for a long time now that he will be running for governor again, but this month made it formal. He held a rally at the Augusta Civic Center, and he had Senator Collins supporting him. Governor LePage has formally, I guess as formal as you can get, announced that he will run for governor in 2022. Did this come as a surprise to you? Are there numbers supporting his chances at winning the Blaine House back?
Well, I don't know if there are numbers because I haven't seen any polling, and I don't know what I would make of polling after the last couple of elections, especially this far out. But certainly he has a chance of being reelected. You know, we are a very sharply divided state in a very sharply divided country, and things tend to break 50-50 if there's another economic downturn. You know, there's some a much bigger outbreak of COVID, there could very easily be an opportunity for a challenger to take on an incumbent like Janet Mills. That said, an incumbent governor has not been beaten, I don't think, any time. And since they went to 4-year terms in the late 60s, and no governor has done what he's trying to do, which is after serving his 8 years, coming back and retaking the seat. I was not surprised that Susan Collins endorsed him. And I was really surprised that a lot of other people were, including a lot of national commentators. They saw it as a very strange move for her, but she endorsed him in 2010 and 2014. And he endorsed her last time in 2020. So I don't, you know, they've had their differences, but they both represent parts of the Republican coalition that the other one needs in order to win statewide. And so it makes a lot of sense that they're that she has spoken out for him. It is a little unusual for her to endorse somebody in a primary, and at least on paper, there appears to be some other Republicans running, but nobody's officially a candidate yet. I don't think anybody should be surprised.
And Ben Bracken, I'm wondering, I'll go to you then, Susan. I'm wondering if your paper's hearing from readers about this. I almost said listeners, a radio term, but readers about Susan Collins supporting Governor LePage. I sure saw a lot on social media.
And we're hearing more about his return to the political stage in general. And I think the big unanswered question, as Greg said, you know, it's kind of unprecedented for a former governor to do this. But he brings a lot of baggage with him. Certainly he has a lot of support among some people in the Republican Party, but a lot of people in Maine remember what those 8 years were like. And, you know, there were the bombastic comments and the questionable behavior, but also the policies that continue to impact Maine. And so one of the big questions, you know, he says that this is LePage 2.0, that he's different this time around, and that he's going to, you know, be more cautious in what he says. We've already seen some evidence that that's not true. So I think one of the big questions is, you know, which Paul LePage shows up for this campaign, and is he truly different than he was in 2010 and 2014, or is it more of the same? And the state has changed a lot since he was elected governor. So as Greg said, anything's possible, but, you know, it's not the same landscape that we were dealing with, certainly when he first ran, and even when he ran for re-election in 2014. So we'll see.
And Ben, I remember the last time we were talking about what will be the 2022 election, you were talking about whether or not there's a third party candidate will be critical. And have we heard anything about that? Does it seem as though there will be a viable third party candidate?
Well, I mean, Tom Salviello's name keeps coming up. He is a former Republican from up in Central Maine who became a Democrat during LePage's time and has really grabbed onto the CMP power corridor as an issue, his opposition to it. You know, and there's some thought, I guess, that issue, because it is... there is a bipartisan distaste for that corridor, and both LePage and Janet Mills are in support of it, that there's a spot there for someone to come in and as a third party and try to take that on. I don't know. I mean, I think it's going to be really hard. I mean, we've seen in past few elections, people kind of coalesce around somebody rather than worry about the third party. And also, I'm not sure where the CMP corridor is going to be as an issue in a year. If, you know, we have this referendum coming in November, and we also have, some court cases that could decide it before then. So that might kind of peter out before then. And I don't know if there's really anybody's appetite for anything more than a LePage and Mills showdown.
All right. Well, we do need to go to another quick break. When we come back, your comments and questions. This is Maine Calling, and we're talking about the month in review.
Listener support brings us Maine Calling with help from Panorama Organic, a U.S. producer of grass-finished beef and a proud partner of the National Audubon Society's Conservation Ranching Program, available at Hannaford, and by Camden National Bank, committed to providing personalized local service by people who live and work in your community. Learn more at camdennational.com.
I'm Tanya Mosley. A farmer in California has had it with all the smoke from wildfires.
We're probably going to move out of the area because we're kind of exhausted.
But it may be difficult to outrun the health impacts. A new investigation finds wildfire smoke is spreading throughout the country. Next time on Here and Now.
Stay with us this morning, Here and Now, upcoming shortly at 12 noon here on Maine Public Radio. Maine Public is seeking new applicants to serve on our Community Advisory Board. The Community Advisory Board serves in an advisory role to Maine Public's Board of Trustees and staff, and it consists of between 15 and 20 volunteer members from around the state who meet twice a year to offer feedback to Maine Public on a variety of topics, including content, programming, audience engagement, and membership. For more information and to apply, please visit mainepublic.org/CAB. And please note that the deadline to apply is October 10th, and thank you for your interest.
Thank you. And welcome back. This is Jennifer Rooks, and this is Maine Calling. Today, we're talking about some of the top news of the month in Maine. My guests, Ben Bragdon with the Kennebec Journal and Morning Sentinel, Susan Young with the Bangor Daily News, and Greg Kessich with the Portland Press Herald and Maine Sunday Telegram. We're going to go now to Sarah Craighead Dedman, who is editor of the Machias Valley News Observer. Thanks, as always, for calling in, Sarah, and thanks for waiting a little while. We've had some technical problems. Talk about COVID-19. I looked at the map of Maine. Washington County is one of the counties with the darker red, which is not good.
That's right, Jennifer. Thanks for having me. We are having our highest case count week so far, and we're only 4 days in. The previous high was 2 weeks ago with 88 cases, and these 4 days have produced 132. As you mentioned, you know, not necessarily all sick this week or tested even this week, but the highest report we've had so far. We're also not doing too well in our hospitalization numbers. We're actually second in the state for our hospitalization rate. We added two new people to that tally this morning. Dr. Shaw talked yesterday about the rural counties and the vaccination divide. Washington County isn't faring too poorly there. We've actually seen almost a 5-point increase in our vaccination rate in September. So we're up to over 65%, which is pretty good. It's in the middle of the pack for the rural counties, but it's all taken its toll. We've had here in Machias, we've had businesses suddenly shutting down for a day, for 10 days. And, we're a pretty small area, so every business that has to close really makes an impact. And a lot of schools have been grappling with closures, too. You mentioned pool testing earlier. The Machias Elementary School, which is the largest in the county, is currently on a remote period. But when they go back, the school is making plans to implement pool testing both there and at the high school. So hopefully that will mitigate any future closures. So, yeah, we're feeling it. We're feeling it here.
And I understand Machias has a new town manager. Tell us about him.
Yeah, this is Bill Kitchen. He's well known in the area. He's actually from away, but he moved here about 10 years ago from New York and just really dove into community life. He's been a public servant alongside his day jobs, serving as a volunteer firefighter, the airport committee, the recreation committee. There's more I could go on. And he also served as a selectman for 3 years, but he's never worked in municipal government. But when the former town manager resigned in May, the town was without a replacement, and the select board turned to Bill, and he stepped in as an interim. And last week, the board and the rest of the search committee unanimously voted in support of offering him the position out of 12 applicants. And so he's a personable guy. He's an enthusiastic guy. He says this is the time for Machias, and he's eager to pick up some of the projects the former town manager had kicked off, such as a wall to protect downtown from sea level rise, some fairly ambitious projects, a crosswind 5,000-foot runway at the airport. So it's kind of exciting times.
All right. And so before we let you go, we have to ask you about Arc Alley Cats. I understand this is a story that is not your everyday story.
That's right. I think it's just so cool. So the Arc Animal Shelter is one of two in Washington County, fairly large area. They carry a lot of weight for dealing with our stray populations. Wow. And they recently received a $40,000 grant from the Soul Foundation, and that will help them fund a trap, you know, trap and neuter program, trap, neuter, and release program for some of the area cat colonies. But recognizing that not all cats are happy living that way, not all cats can be adopted out as barn buddies or domestic pets, they've also got this neat thing where they have 80 acres of land, and they're getting ready to take delivery of a really large and tall building that will become a feral cat shelter. So it'll sit in the middle of these 80 acres, and those cats that can't be taken care of any other way will be taken to this house. It'll be floor to ceiling carpeted cat places to hang out, and they'll be fed and they'll be warm, and if they want to wander, you know, they won't be bothering anyone. So they kind of like a little cat city out in the middle of the woods here. They're
based in Cherryfield. Oh my gosh. Yeah. Cat city in the middle of Cherryfield. Sarah, always looking forward to hearing from you. Thank you so much for calling in. Sarah Craighead Dedman, the editor of the Machias Valley News Observer. And joining us now, Bob Berta, publisher of Countywide Newspaper. Bob, tell us about the Medibamps Dam removal.
Oh, thanks, Jennifer. It's always good to talk to you and get the other view of Machias. Yeah, we had our lead writer, Brian Schwartz, wrote a centerfold story about a joint project removing a fish-blocking dam in Medibamps. And what was important about this story, I believe, is the three partnerships involved in it. I wish Brian was here to report this to you, but it's partly a state, partly a private organization, the Down East Salmon Federation, and the Passamaquoddy Tribe was all part of this. And this is a generator in the 1940s. It was done by Harry Smith Sr. And in the 1970s, his son took over, and he actually punched a hole into the dam so fish could access this. And so five of Maine's Atlantic salmon fishery runs on rivers are in Washington County. So this is a good step.
And this was removed this past month?
September 14th in the morning, 10 a.m. in the morning.
Wow. Was it a backhoe? How did it come out?
Well, here's something. I sent Jonathan a copy, and if any of your any of your listeners would want this, if they send us a request to countywidesports@hotmail.com, I'd be more than glad to have it sent out. We don't send them out on the internet, but we would do this for this particular project.
Okay. Well, Bob, thanks so much for calling in. I appreciate it. Bob Berta, publisher of Countywide Newspaper. Going to go to some of our other callers here. We're going to go to Richard, who's calling from Falmouth. Hi, Richard. Go ahead. Richard in Falmouth, are you there? Okay, we'll move along then. We'll go to Jamie in Harpswell. Jamie, can you hear me?
Yeah.
Go ahead.
Can you hear me?
Yep, go ahead.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. My question is about energy policy in Maine, and a lot has been reported on the corridor stuff, but there hasn't been any reporting on pipeline expansion, particularly the Westbrook Express project, which the final stages of were approved by the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission June of 2020. The projected emissions from the compressor station in Westbrook, the increase from this project is over 230,000 tons per year of harmful gases, greenhouse gases. And I wonder why the papers haven't even included this project in the public notice section. Thanks for taking my call.
Yeah, turning to our editors, any of you familiar with this story?
Yeah, I mean, I'm not particularly familiar with that project, but I would say that the big difference between the way pipelines are regulated and the power line is that the pipeline regulation is done almost entirely federally, and not there's no state and local participation the way there is we're seeing with the power line, and from a a climate perspective, I think Jamie is raising a really important point, is that it's very easy to build pipelines that move carbon producing fossil fuels, and very difficult to move electricity, which is where we're supposed to be going. So as a country, we've built a lot more pipelines in the last decade than electric transmission lines.
All right, Jamie, thanks for your call. I think we might have Richard back, so we'll give him a try again. Richard calling from Falmouth, go ahead.
Hi, can you hear me now?
I can, go ahead.
Oh, very good. I've been one of the governor's biggest fans when it comes to handling the pandemic, but not so much in the past couple of months. I mean, she's tried very hard to encourage and educate and beg and bribe people to be vaccinated. And I think we're pretty much hitting a wall at this point. And I think the mandate day is here. And, all state employees, as an example, I would mandate that they be vaccinated. Her mandate for healthcare workers, I don't find very impressive. It's my understanding that doesn't include, for example, the primary care offices, the specialty offices, where I'm much more likely to go for care than the hospital.
Sure.
So,
Richard, I'll put your question to our panel. Susan, I'll turn to you. Are you hearing this from others as well, that they wish that Governor Mills would be tougher and mandate more?
Sure. I mean, a lot of people who are vaccinated and who believe they've done the right thing are very frustrated that other folks aren't vaccinated and, would like them to just get it done. There's been a lot of polling and focus groups on messaging with the folks who are vaccine hesitant, and telling them what to do, and in their view, hectoring them or being condescending to them is not effective. So we're not getting those folks on board. As for the mandate, there's concern that some employers are gonna lose a lot of people who will choose not to be vaccinated. That doesn't seem to be playing out in other states like New York that's already have a mandate in effect for healthcare workers that, there are people who quit their jobs, but it's a small number. So I think it's an ongoing debate on how effective mandates will be and how broad they need to be. And we'll begin to see, as you said, it goes into effect tomorrow. The enforcement's not till the end of the month, but does that encourage a lot of folks in the healthcare industry who are not vaccinated to get vaccinated?
Richard, thanks for your call. We want to go to an email here. This is from Carl in New Gloucester, and it's a long email, so I'll just read part of it. He's talking about the Kennebec River and the economics of the Chaumont Dam and the other three dams. He's making a point that these really don't generate that much electricity compared to other things such as offshore wind, which might be has such great potential for the future. He writes, "So it appears we are willing to drive the Atlantic salmon to extinction in the U.S. so that we can have a small 110-year-old outdated dam so Brookfield can make some more bucks for a few more years." Greg Kesich, bring us up to date. Where are we in this saga of what will happen with four dams on the Kennebec River?
Well, there's four dams and there's at least three sides in this fight. And it's all around what the state should be doing to regulate fish. I'm forgetting the word, but the fish that go live part of their lives in the ocean.
Andronomous.
Andronymous, thank you. You know,
I don't know where that came from. Somewhere in the research.
But, you know, briefly, where we stand is that the dam owners say that they have agreements that go back to 1998 with the state about what they need to do to make sure the fish can pass their dams. And that the state has to live up to those agreements. The state says that there's regulations that supersede those agreements in the last 23 years. And then environmentalists, including the Conservation Law Foundation, are saying that the state is not meeting its obligation under the regulations. And this is one of those situations where I say, thank God we have a court system, because this is where it's going to end up. The dam owners have sued. They've filed suit before on this issue, and all these competing interests will be hashed out. And in terms of what the law says and who's responsible for what.
All right. And I know we have just a few seconds left, but Ben Bragdon, we're looking at probably not a matter of months, but a matter of years before this is resolved.
Yeah, as Greg said, I mean, it's a long process, and it's going to take a long time to work out. I know there's people on both sides of the political spectrum up in our area, Central Maine, that are getting on the side of the dams of relicensing. It's going to take a while to sort this out, and I wouldn't be surprised if it's somewhat of an issue in next year's governor's race.
All right. And a correction here from our producer, Cindy Hahn. I mispronounced it. It's anadromous. So word for the day, if you're playing Scrabble or want to try to stump your friends. Thank you all for joining us today. Our panel of editorial page editors, Susan Young with the Bangor Daily News, Greg Kessich of the Portland Press, Herald and Maine Sunday Telegram, and Ben Bragdon with the Kennebec Journal and Morning Sentinel. Today's sound engineers, KG Akimoladun and George Thomas. Maine Calling, produced by Jonathan Smith and Cindy Hahn. This is Maine Calling on Maine Public Radio.